From UFOs to psychic powers and government conspiracies, history is riddled with unexplained events. You can turn back now or learn the stuff they don't want you to know. A production of iHeartRadio.
Hello and welcome back to the show. My name is Noel.
Our ride or die Matt Frederick is most likely playing Best Fiends while he's on vacation. They called me Ben. We are joined, as always, with our super producer, Paul Mission Control Deck. And most importantly, you are you. You are here. And that makes this Stuff They Don't Want You to Know. This is a very interesting episode. It's one that has fascinated good pal Matt for a number of years. This episode is something that he cares deeply about, so we're gonna do our best to make him proud.
Speaking of Matt, you blasted right by this whole Best Fiends business. We got a bombshell yesterday that Matt Frederick has reached level 764 in the mobile game Best Fiends, and I don't know whether to be proud of him or concerned for him.
I mean, that's, you know, he's nothing if not a passionate dude. But I was likewise surprised. Now, you know, Noel, if there's one thing that longtime listeners have learned from Stuff They Don't Want You to Know, it's this: you can blast by a lot of headlines. You can get a lot of buried leads. The mainstream news is a fickle, ephemeral thing. Some stories that seem pretty innocuous can receive international attention. Like, remember when the world was obsessed over figuring out what color a dress was on Facebook?
What was the determination ultimately? Beige? Was it red? What were the choices? And how do you even interpret this, Ben, with your color deficiency? Did you feel left out of that story?
No, I wouldn't have participated even
exactly,
if I could have known what color. I think it was blue, or it was gold, or it was black. There was a whole thing. But there are other stories, though, tremendously important stories that seem to fade from the spotlight. And they're only followed up on by people in specialized internet forums or in specialized trade publications. For example, this is weird, you know. Today's story comes to us from Josh P. Josh P., you emailed us to ask about the anthrax attacks of 2001. Now, right as we say that, a lot of us in the audience are going, huh, anthrax, I kind of remember that, right? I know it's a thing, but what do you mean? Well, to answer that question, we have to first tell you what anthrax is. So here are the facts.
Yeah, so just to get it out of the way, no, not the thrash metal band from the 90s with that bald dude with the amazing goatee that you may have seen on episodes of Beavis and Butthead. The CDC describes anthrax as a serious infectious disease that's caused by something referred to as gram-positive rod-shaped bacteria, referred to as Bacillus anthracis. And it is something that can absolutely sicken people when it's inhaled, or when they come into contact with infected animals or foodstuffs. Another way of looking at it is that it's a spore-forming bacillus that is absolutely deadly to humans. And there are three main forms of transmission: cutaneous, which is when you contract it through the skin. Gastrointestinal, which of course is when you would ingest it when, you know, eating a contaminated food product. And then there is pulmonary, which is mainly what we're going to be talking about today, which is when it is inhaled.
Yeah. Yep. That's correct. So a lot of countries have stockpiled anthrax for a long time. When you hear people talking about bioweapon research, they're usually referring to things like anthrax, because picture anthrax like, picture it like an agricultural product. With the right know-how, you can grow it, you can groom it, and you can change it into various mediums of consumption, right? Like you said, with oral or pulmonary or cutaneous inhalation or ingestion. So behind the scenes, while everybody is worrying about what color a dress is or what the Kardashians are doing or, you know, what the newest season of your favorite television show is, governments and private partnerships around the world are constantly experimenting with diseases. They're refining them. You're usually going to hear about these in terms of national defense, right? Like I'm sure, you know, if you went to the CDC, they would say, we're not making bioweapons, we're researching vaccines, right? We're trying to save people, not harm them.
That's right. And you might hear a term like weaponized grade, you know, like weapons grade plutonium or weaponized anthrax. And that just means it's refined to the point of being more easily dispersed, you know, through, say, air ducts, you know, in a building, for example. Or, you know, it's when I say refined, I literally mean made into a fine substance that can be released and become very, very dangerous because it is transmitted through, you know, airflow in the case of like a building or even outdoors.
Yeah, yeah. And when we talk about these experts who are working on, depending on what you believe, working on either weaponizing diseases or on creating cures for these diseases, they also work on plans, on scenarios, right? They work on what's called emergency preparedness plans.
Yeah, and the CDC on their website does have an emergency preparedness plan in place for an anthrax attack, but in my opinion, and I'm no expert, it seems pretty broad and kind of vague, almost more of a stop, drop, and roll situation than actually some sort of larger government response plan that's in place. And it's interesting, in more recent times, focus truly seems to have shifted away from, you know, bioterrorism protection and more towards pandemic preparedness. Though, based on our current situation, that does not seem to have worked out quite so well. So, you know, the jury is still out on that. But bioterrorism was much more of a top of mind thing during these attacks that we're going to talk about today.
Right. Yes. Fellow conspiracy realists, you may remember this story from several years ago, almost 20 years ago now. Beginning on September 18th, 2001, just a week after the infamous terrorist attacks on September 11th, 2001, someone started mailing letters laced with anthrax. They sent these to several places: ABC, NBC, CBS, The New York Post, American Media. That's such a benign name. American Media is probably best known as the publisher of the National Enquirer, a quite popular tabloid here in the U.S. And they also sent sent anthrax-laced letters to members of Congress.
That's correct. Two Democratic senators, Tom Daschle and Patrick Leahy. On October 2nd, 2001, the gentleman at the American Media Building in Florida, which is, again, the parent company of the National Enquirer, and also The Sun, a photo editor by the name of Robert Stevens, opened an innocuously labeled envelope and was exposed to anthrax. There were various methods in these letters of dispersal, but like some of them were more successful than others. And I believe this is one where he pulled something out of the envelope and it actually kind of ejected powder into his face. And he really took a deep whiff of this, this substance.
Yep, absolutely. That's correct. 2 days later, October 4th, 2001, Robert Stevens is diagnosed with what's called inhalational anthrax, meaning he ingested it just the way you described, Noel. Robert Stevens dies the next day, October 5th, 2001. And 3 days later, authorities start running tests on his office, on his workspace, and they find that his computer keyboard also tests positive for anthrax. This was only the first confirmed death. Overall, So far as we know, today in 2020, the anthrax attacks of 2001 left 17 people infected and five people died from exposure to anthrax. This became a international story. And the problem with some of these international stories is that for one reason or another, copycats come into play.
That's right. There was another copycat crime that occurred when someone else mailed fake anthrax in the form of just a harmless white powder, possibly baby powder or something like that, to the New York Times newsroom. And it was opened by a reporter named Judith Miller. And it really just goes to show, because of what you said, Ben, that this truly just was a massive story, because it was in the wake of 9/11, where people were just so on edge already and just really believing that terrorism was coming at us from all directions. And the close proximity to that attack on the World Trade Center buildings really got people freaked out. And the FBI acted accordingly, launching what they refer to as one of the largest and most complex investigations in the history of law enforcement, and involved multiple agencies and thousands of hours of investigative time.
So what did they find? Well, we have to remember, as you said, that this occurred right after 9/11. It is impossible to convey just how alert, how tense, how crisis ready government agencies were. You have to remember, folks, that war was in the air way before the anthrax. It was already floating around. And war is its own sort of infectious weapon, right? Its own sort of disease. The FBI scrambled and assembled what I think is a terribly named task force, the Amerithrax Task Force. We didn't write that. They wrote that.
It just does not really roll right off the tongue, does it? But, you know, name aside, it was serious business. Roughly 25 to 30 full-time investigators from the FBI and the U.S. Postal Inspection Service and multiple other law enforcement agencies, as well as federal prosecutors from the District of Columbia and the Justice Department Counterterrorism Section. And as we said before, thousands of investigator work hours were involved that led to 10,000 witness interviews on 6 different continents, execution of 80 search warrants, and the recovery of more than 6,000 items of potential evidence during this investigation.
And you heard that right. 6 different continents. So that means that the Amerithrax Task Force literally asked people everywhere except for Antarctica. Somehow, the folks in Antarctica slipped under the radar. This case also ended up issuing more than 5,750 subpoenas for grand juries. They collected 5,730 environmental samples from 60 different places. They were on the search. This investigation, in addition to being very expensive, was very thorough. Here's what they found. Here's how it shakes out. So FBI agents trace the first wave of letters to a single postmark. These letters came from Trenton, New Jersey, and that's the first 5 letters. They had a theme of sorts. You know, the letters weren't blank. When people opened the envelope, there was something written in there. And we've got the text of these. Let's maybe start with the letter sent to New York Post and NBC.
Absolutely. And by the way, if you want, you can look up images of these. They've been cataloged and photographed, and you can see them. They're all handwritten in kind of a weird childish script. It's very serial killer-esque, honestly, the way they appear. And the notes really lean into that even further. So the one sent to the New York Post and the NBC News had this note: 9/11/01. This is next. Take penicillin now. Cool. Pro tip. Death to America. Death to Israel. Allah is great. Okay, it seems to have escalated there to a little different place, but I appreciate the the advice about taking penicillin. I think that's actually really helpful, you know.
They also misspelled penicillin, by the way.
It's true. But also, by the way, you know, people think of Anthrax and they think, like, I don't know, your mind immediately goes to some sort of face melting, you know, bioterror product. And it really just sickens you. It can make you nauseous. And it's a respiratory thing that can obviously kill you in the same way that COVID-19 can. I mean, it can escalate much more quickly, but it is treatable with regular antibiotics. You know, it's not a death sentence always. It's caught in enough time. So it's not some kind of magical thing. It literally is just a disease that can be treated with antibiotics.
And we should note instantly, you know, the FBI investigators had to say, well, is this a person writing English as a second language? You know, are they ESL? Is that why penicillin is misspelled? And of course, you know, there was a lot of anti-Muslim sentiment at the time. The letters sent to Senators Daschle and Leahy said very similar things. They said, you cannot stop us. We have this anthrax. You die now. Are you afraid? Death to America. Death to Israel. Allah is great. So clearly they're coming from the same source, just based on the language there. You know, it is very difficult to describe the level of panic that occurs here. We have to remember this is, again, a week after the largest attack on American soil in recent U.S. history.
Yeah. So, I mean, obviously the first go-to is to investigate Al-Qaeda. The White House pressured then FBI Director Robert Mueller to establish that the letters were a second wave of attacks relating to 9/11. And it's always tough when, you know, the brass kind of tells you what results to get. You know what I mean? Because the question is, like, you know, sure, we can read these and say, okay, is it an ESL situation or is it someone trying to write in that voice as to create that effect, you know what I mean? To maybe cause that kind of panic. So yeah, obviously that didn't pan out, this notion that this was in fact a second wave, but that was what everyone thought. I mean, it was just the first place your mind would go, hence the hysteria that was just, you know, in the air in our country at that time.
Yeah, yeah. And Mueller was definitely under pressure. But, you know, from his estimation, the facts just weren't there. There was one potential link. One of the 9/11 terrorists was exposed to anthrax at some point, but that was pretty much all they could find. The initial actual suspects of the investigation ended up all being domestic U.S. residents. There were probably about 100 people or so who would have the know-how, just the know-how alone, just the expertise, not even the motivation or the opportunity. The FBI first turned to a man named Stephen J. Hatfill. Dr. Hatfill is alive today. He is a pathologist, he's a bioweapons expert, and the FBI ruined his life.
Yeah, for all intents and purposes. In mid-2002, the FBI served him with a search warrant of his home, wearing hazmat suits, investigating whether he was, in fact, this anthrax killer, as was dubbed in the media at the time. He was, at that point, considered a major person of interest. His phone was tapped. He got fired from his job at Science Applications International Corporation. Yeah, like you said, Ben, I mean, this really, you know, in the terms of the court of public opinion and just his other associations professionally, this absolutely railroaded him. He did ultimately get exonerated. He was a very public exoneration. There's a great clip of him where he says, you know, now I can look my fellow Americans in the eye and say unequivocally, I am not the anthrax killer, you know. And he definitely got some money where his mouth was, in the form of $5.8 million from the Justice Department and in two other undisclosed settlements from some of these other agencies that were involved. It was very clear that they were acting on spurious evidence at best, and made really jump the gun on nailing this guy in the way they did.
Yeah, I like that you bring up the court of public opinion. One of those groups that reached an undisclosed settlement with him was Condé Nast. It's a huge player in the media. They own Reddit, for instance. So So Hatfield, luckily, if you're listening, Dr. Hatfield, we are glad that you were able to be exonerated for a crime that you clearly did not commit. But it's tough to recover from that sort of stuff. And he was ultimately found innocent of this crime. The primary conclusion of the FBI, the official story, is this. They concluded that a scientist named Bruce Ivins, acting alone, was the source of the entirety of the anthrax attacks. And he has, if you're a profiler, he has all of the right red flags in all of the right places. He worked directly with anthrax. He was one of those people that we mentioned at the top of the show who develops vaccines. So he was working with anthrax officially to develop vaccines in case some other government had a weaponized strain that they deployed in the U.S. or in a, you know, battlefield.
And Ben, wasn't he even involved in the investigation to a degree?
Yeah, he volunteered.
Right.
He volunteered to test samples. He sent samples from his own lab. He was around 55 years old when the anthrax attacks occurred. He said, you know, I will help you determine the origin of the powder, because everybody in the scientific community, everybody in the FBI, they knew only a few people in the world would even understand the science involved here. So remember that part for later, folks. This guy volunteered to help the FBI determine the origin of the powder.
And let's not forget how much pressure the FBI was under, especially since this public exoneration and having that egg on their face from wasting all those millions of dollars and thousands of hours, you know, focusing on the wrong perp. Dr. Ivins was literally right under their noses. I mean, he was working, you know, in their labs, essentially. I mean, he was an agent of the government, and he, you know, was kind of a goofball. He was sort of a kook, really. Like, he was described as being a bit arrogant and something of a flamboyant figure. And, you know, that was a term that was thrown around. I'm not sure if that's meant to be a pejorative or just that he was kind of a little bit kooky. That's kind of the vibe that I got, but not necessarily a red flag in terms that he seemed like some kind of sociopath. He would send these, like, chipper emails with bad dad jokes, which I can get behind, as he talked through the dangers of anthrax. But he was, by some, seen as being a bit disturbed.
Yes, that's correct. Behind those puns, behind those cheerful exclamation marks and tangents in his emails, which the FBI obtained, of course, he had a lot of trauma. His therapist said that he had a traumatic childhood and was described as disturbing. And he himself, as an adult, seemed to be disturbed. He was a married man, but back in 1976, he was jilted by a fellow grad student who would go on to be a colleague in this field, a Dr. Nancy Hagwood. And since he was jilted, again, back in 1976, he had apparently become obsessed with her old sorority, Kappa Kappa Gamma, and sororities in general.
One Yikes. Of his boss,
yeah. He would sit outside of sorority houses, just sit in his car, and he would, you know, when he met a colleague who was affiliated with a sorority, he would instantly start, I don't know, like, pressuring them, cracking down. He got weird with it.
Yeah, but there's also part of me that, like, is he just socially awkward and maybe a bit on the spectrum, or is this stalkery kind of rapey behavior in saying, what's your secret password? What's your secret handshake? It seems kind of like a goofball way of flirting, like saying, ha ha, what's your secret handshake? You know what I mean? As opposed to something genuinely creepy. But he was described as having an interest intellectually in secret things.
Yeah, this recollection comes from one of his former bosses, Dr. Priscilla Wierick. She had a, she was in a sorority in college, Chi Omega, and she said that he was doing exactly what you described, Noel. He was always saying, you know, what's your secret password? What's your secret handshake? So she thought that he was just maybe, as you said, a guy who was a little bit off, brilliant, but a little bit awkward, who was really interested in secret things. The person we mentioned earlier, Dr. Nancy Hakewood, is the person who actually brought Dr. Bruce Ivins to the attention of the FBI. So what was their official conclusion? We'll tell you after a word from our sponsor. And we're back. So Noel, officially, there's no reason for us to look into this for stuff they don't want you to know, because the FBI has an official conclusion, right?
Nothing I trust more than an official FBI conclusion, Ben, let me tell you. So yeah, it's true. Today, the FBI's official position is that Dr. Bruce Ivins was a lone wolf, acted without any influence outside of his own troubled mind, and that he executed these anthrax attacks alone. And there's some things that check out here. He had the know-how. He had the access. He had the opportunity to do these things. But he never confessed, and to boot, he's not in prison. Dr. Bruce Ivins took his own life. He was discovered on July 27th, 2008, unconscious in his home, and taken to the hospital. He had overdosed, apparently, on Tylenol 3, I think is what it's called. It's a combination of Tylenol and codeine that you'd get for a toothache or a minor surgery. But taken in large doses is actually the Tylenol that kills you.
Yeah. Yep. He died at Frederick Memorial Hospital on July 29th, 2008. The FBI had found their bad guy. They would never have to investigate further. They established to their, you know, to their satisfaction, the timeline. They established that he did, as you said, have the expertise. They established that he did have the opportunity. Do want to note, by the way, there was no official autopsy. There's not one. There's not one on the record because, again, there's this pressure. We got to close the case. You know, it's something that's very familiar to fans of shows like The Wire. The FBI found their guy, but their guy didn't have a day in court.
No, with Ivins dead, the FBI would never have to prove their case to a jury. And we're going to get into, you know, what their case was as we progress with this episode. But what if, Ben? What if the official story kind of peters out in 08? What if another story begins? Because the case against Bruce Ivins isn't nearly as ironclad as the news media and the press conferences and briefings from the FBI would have had viewers and citizens of the United States believe.
Mm-hmm. You see, one thing that was missing from the FBI's case, one of several things, was a real motive. There wasn't one established. And this means that in the almost a decade between when these attacks occurred and when this podcast publishes, theories have proliferated. Speculation thrives even now about what actually happened. The big question, the big what if here is, what if after millions of dollars and thousands of hours, the FBI nailed the wrong man? Here's where it gets crazy. No, let's like motivation, right? I love that you pointed out the flamboyant thing, but the FBI didn't ever have like a clear, discernible reason.
Yeah, and another thing we know from like murder shows is, you know, some murders don't have to have a motive. It's not like a requirement. But with such an analytical guy like this and such a pointed, targeted attack, a motive, I would like to hear a little bit more about a motive. You know what I mean? Like, I mean, these were very specific individuals, politicians, news outlets that these letters were sent to. Seemingly for what? You know, we really just don't have it. Did the guy just crack? And if so, why such a specific, targeted, and pointed attack? Again, we're not owed a motive. It's not a necessity to, you know, convict somebody of a crime. The possible motivations, like the idea that he mailed anthrax to NBC as a way of punishing them for journalist Gary Matsumoto's work on his lab, that fell apart because Matsumoto worked at ABC, not NBC. And he had written some not very flattering stories about some of Ivan's research. Ben, isn't that right?
Yeah, that's correct. He did an investigation into the actual lab that Dr. Bruce Ivins was working at. But again, he worked for ABC, not NBC. So that motivation doesn't add up, because if Ivins did this, he would have at least been aware of which news organization this journalist was working for at the time. Additionally, Dr. Ivins passed a lie detector test, a polygraph. Polygraphs, we should mention here, I've got a brain stuff episode about this, I think. They're not scientifically sound, but it is rare for a guilty person to pass a lie detector test, usually, unless you know a few handy tricks. Here they are, really quick. Not saying that you should ever lie on a polygraph, but if you want to pass a polygraph test, again, because they are not scientifically sound, you can employ any number of tricks, including doing some things to mess with your own body temperature, such as meditation, etc. You can, this is fairly explicit, but back in the day, people used to just really flex their Kegel muscle for an extended amount of time. That'll do it. You could put thumbtacks in your palm or in your shoe, of course. There are a number of ways to invalidate it.
Because it's all about sort of messing with that base level, that baseline, right? And then, you know, because what's the polygraph if not just kind of a slightly, you know, more complex like stress test? So if you can establish a baseline using that thumbtack in your palm, that's, you know, sort of an elevated baseline, then everything else is going to kind of, you know, be affected by that.
Absolutely. And we also know that during the investigation, even right after the conclusion of the investigation and right after it was re-examined, first in 2008, then in 2011, a lot of people in power, some like victims of these attacks, did not believe the FBI's conclusion. They thought it didn't add up.
Yeah, even Senator Patrick Leahy, who you'll remember was the target of one of the attacks, testified that he did not believe that Ivins acted alone, though Senator Daschle, who was the other political target, did not agree with that assessment. So in 2008, FBI Director Robert Mueller, you know, figured, okay, if there's doubt, you know, that's being publicly stated, let's get to the bottom of this. And he called for an independent review of the investigation by the National Academy of Sciences. And that review found that prosecutors had largely overstated the case in the certainty of their findings. Members of that committee said that there were some newly available methods for testing these samples of anthrax to prove the FBI's case much more definitively or lead to some other suspects. But they were not interested in exploring such tests. They relied on some, I believe it was a sort of a fingerprint to trace it back to what they refer to as a flask of anthrax that Ivins had control over. And it has a coded kind of ID that I'm having a hard time finding right now, but it's like two letters, a dash, and three numbers. And the technique involved tracing these particular mutations that they could, you know, kind of match up with the actual the flask that where it originated. And apparently they tested more than 1,000 samples throughout this investigation, and only 8 of them had tested positive for 4 of these mutations found in the germs that were sent to Congress and the news media. So there, this caused an issue even in the early stages of the investigation. There was a group of scientists known as the Red Team that said the FBI should do more basic research into why those mutations might have arisen, that it wasn't a foregone conclusion just because the mutations existed that they necessarily were, you know, traced back to that original flask. And that this woman named Jennifer Smith, who is a senior manager at the FBI's lab, she expressed those concerns and didn't feel that the FBI had a kind of full understanding of how these mutations might have arisen and how this would be seen by a judge and how it could potentially be thrown out entirely.
Right, right. The science is vital here. That specific, let's say, brand or type of anthrax flask, RMR 1029. The reason we know this is because everything should be obsessively documented in the field of biohazard research or bioweapons, right? If you are working in the kind of lab or situation that Dr. Ivins was working in at the time, your interactions with every single version of every single contagion has to be documented, right? So that we know, looking at the records, we know every time the guy was in his lab. We know that his time in the lab on weekends and nights accelerated, right? He was spending a lot of time there before the attacks occurred. And we should know everything the guy touched. But even now, even in 2020, just like the experts you mentioned earlier, Noel, we find large groups of people, including some of the doctor's colleagues and some of his professional rivals, who are convinced that this man was innocent. And, you know, the basis for their belief is not that they are in a Bruce Edward Ivins fan club. In fact, one of the reasons that a lot of people say he's innocent is that they say the attacks were too sophisticated for this guy to have figured out himself. The argument is basically, yes, he had the know-how and the expertise to experiment with anthrax and maybe even to grow this particular strain, but he had no training in the delivery of bioweapons, which I think goes right to your earlier point about how botched this attack was.
Yeah, that's true. And that all, honestly, to me, in some ways, makes it seem like it could have been him, because if it were executed by a more, you know, savvy group, then they maybe would have had a better delivery method, because, you know, anthrax is toxic up to the tiniest particles. And like we said at the top of the show, you know, if dispersed through ducts of an office building, could potentially infect thousands of people. And as we know, the fatality count and even just the people that were sickened by these was relatively quite low, you know? Definitely didn't seem like it went as planned. But at the same time, the spores of anthrax were like Walter White, Breaking Bad level, like strong, high quality. You could, you know, call them something along the lines of weapons grade, which is, you know, sort of a vague term that doesn't necessarily mean one thing, but it's the type, basically the finest anthrax grade that can be produced for bioweapons programs in either the U.S. or somewhere like Russia.
I want to interject here. Yeah, the reason I think Breaking Bad is a great comparison, this is like the blue meth level of weaponized anthrax. And there's a scary thing here that often gets ignored in this story, which is this. The spores of anthrax, not to get too far in the weeds, they were only 1.5 to 3 micrometers wide, individual spores. And it is fine grade. You're correct. It is Walter White level. This type of anthrax is smaller than the officially acknowledged or even open secret level bioweapons created by the U.S. or by Russia. That should disturb people, because that means that someone, somewhere, is making something that neither world power there acknowledges.
Which isn't that much of a stretch. We know that governments hold back technology all the time, you know, and keep it for military use, and they wouldn't necessarily want to broadcast that they have that. That's not something that they just, like, announce, hey, we made a scarier version of anthrax, you guys, like, check it out. But no, yeah. it's true. And again, when we say fine grade, we literally are talking about the particulate size, because that's what allows it to be just dispersed. Like the wind can pick it up like a, you know, a dandelion down and just carry it across the land, infecting, you know, everything in its path potentially. I mean, obviously you have to breathe it in, but these are, you know, they could be, you know, just millions of tiny, tiny, tiny particles in an envelope of full of powder, a powdered version of this stuff, right?
And you're opening it indoors. Yeah. And there are a lot of people around. So yeah, you know, at the risk of sounding cold, it is surprising that only 17 people were infected. There's another problem with this official conclusion, and that's this. Dr. Ivan's colleagues and people familiar with the lab can confirm that the lab equipment cited in the FBI conclusion, the lab equipment that he would have to have used to create this stuff and to disperse it, that lab equipment was not working. He did not have the capability to make the spores if he were using the equipment in that lab, full stop. It was there, yes, he had the know-how, but that equipment was broken down at the time. You know what I mean? You can see how this gets messy so quickly.
Yeah, you absolutely can. And just again, to clarify, like we're talking about the flask. That would be sort of like the mother, right? Like that's sort of the origin material for what he would have used to then, I guess, propagate them or grow them into, you know, a more usable version of anthrax and then, you know, make it into the powder. So, that would require a lot of know-how and a lot of very sophisticated equipment. And if it wasn't working in his lab, what did he, like, have a secret lab like at his house? I mean, maybe, I you know, who are we to say? But it definitely was highly unlikely that he made it with this broken down equipment at his lab. And numerous government officials and scientists also believe that this official story doesn't add up. And there are numerous theories that have kind of circulated in the years since this conclusion about Dr. Ivans. And we're going to get into all of those after a quick word from our sponsor.
And we're back. Yes, the conspiracies, the theories, the speculation thrives and proliferates. And to be clear, the people who are proposing these alternative conclusions or these problems with the official investigation, they're not what you would call tinfoil hat people. They include people who were working with the FBI in the investigation. They include scientists. They include experts in anthrax. And they have a lot of valid concerns here. Dr. Ivans, as I believe we said at the top, was only one of at least 100 people who could have worked with this specific brand of anthrax, of course, RMR-1029. Not the sexiest name, but it's a technical term. The
far superior to RMR-1028. Really, it was a good year.
Don't even talk to me about 1028. Are you kidding? 1029. Come on. That's the connoisseur's choice, apparently. But he was not the only person who would have touched this. Also, the FBI did not have a peer review of their conclusions, of the scientific end of it, during their investigation. The science, in short, to be very clear, the science was not there.
Yeah, taking it a step further, even a 2011 review of the investigation was not able to rule out the possibility that someone or some group other than Ivans committed the crime. The Government Accountability Office, or GAO, as I like to call it, because I'm an acronym junkie, found this, quote, "The FBI lacked a comprehensive approach or framework that could have ensured standardization of the testing process." We jumped into that a little early when we were talking about testing for that mutation or those mutations. and how people even within the FBI's lab kind of warned them against, you know, jumping to conclusions about what could have caused those mutations. They could have been something outside of what they were, using it as like kind of a foregone conclusion and tracing it back. It's sort of like, I don't know, maybe this is a stretch, and science people, please debunk the crap out of me because I'm just sort of spitballing here, but it reminds me of the way certain ballistics technology have kind of been debunked, where you can, you know, say the striations or whatever, like on a particular bullet, could have only been generated by this one gun. And there's a version of that technology that was in fact debunked, and it caused some people to be exonerated because they were convicted using that kind of spurious conclusion derived from, you know, something that could have been caused by other factors. So they go on to say, the Government Accountability Office, as a result, each of the contractors developed their tests differently. And one contractor did not conduct verification testing, which is a key step in determining whether a test will meet a user's requirements, such as for sensitivity or accuracy.
Broken test sounds familiar, unfortunately, and these are days of pandemic. So if there are problems with the FBI's official investigation, does that mean there are problems with the FBI's official conclusion? The answer there, logically, is yes. So now we have to ask what actually happened. And that means that we have to look at the conspiracies. There's one, you know, that's pretty interesting, because a lot of people don't know this, but before Vice President Mike Pence was in office in the U.S., he had a different career as a prominent radio host, and then he moved into politics. He had some stuff to say about this investigation, right?
Yeah, he did. He kind of just made some sort of shot in the dark kind of claims, released some statements saying some pretty interesting things about this substance. He essentially said, quote, in a statement, the material found in my office and in others in Capitol Hill was finely milled weapons grade anthrax that had been, this is the key part, genetically modified to increase its virulence. Huh. What does that mean, Ben? Genetically modified.
I mean, it's the same thing, right? He's arguing that this was weaponized, and again, we have to remember that this stuff was officially better than anything the U.S. or Russia or China could make. He was, I think, at that point, he was a representative, right? He was a congressional representative before he became governor of Indiana, before he became vice president.
That's right. And you know, I mean, he's the notion that it was quote unquote weapons grade obviously is true to a degree, though the term is a little bit dubious in terms of like how it's used. The idea of weapons grade, there isn't really a standard as to what constitutes weapons grade anthrax. The LA Times reported in an article by David Willman from July 16th of 2016, and they spoke to researcher at Johns Hopkins University named Stephen L. Salzberg, who was actually part of the first team to check out the material for the U.S. government. And he said, that's just wrong. That's simply wrong. And we knew at the time that it was wrong. He's speaking, of course, of Pence's claims. And then Pence even kind of doubled down further and said something to the effect of, oh, it was coated with a chemical of some kind. Like, he definitely added some more fuel to this fire in saying in a 2002 letter to Ashcroft, the attorney general, that the spores had been, quote, coated with a chemical. And that had also been disproven by scientists at the Sandia National Laboratory in New Mexico.
Yeah, but a few months before he told Ashcroft that.
That's right. And I'm fascinated by this idea of it being genetically modified. And it's interesting, too, because Colin Powell, who is the Secretary of State, he used this as, you know, we know was a thing, you know, in terms of weapons of mass destruction. He used this as another call to kind of go to war with Iraq, to support military action against Iraq, that, you know, tying these anthrax attacks. And as we did 9/11, which we now know really wasn't the case at all. And we used that as an excuse to go to war with Iraq, and that sort of got us embroiled in the Middle East in a way that we're still kind of dealing with today.
Still friends with the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia, though. You want to kill some journalists? You want to support some terrorists? That's fine. We'll see how oil prices affect that geopolitical relationship. But that's a story for another day. You're right. You know, people immediately tied this to terrorism. Death to America, death to Israel, Allah is great, so on. We also have to remember that at this time, millions of innocent Americans are being vilified in the media for their religious beliefs, right? It's as dumb and disgusting as any other sort of prejudice. So when we're talking about the belief of terrorism or something, or, you know, the idea that religiously motivated terrorists might have perpetrated the anthrax attacks, we're specifically talking about Al-Qaeda. We're not talking about some general amorphous thing. We're talking about a real, concrete, discrete, existing organization that did have a track record, a rap sheet of committing terrorist acts.
Absolutely. And let's also remember that this was used as kind of, you know, a media device. Powell held a press conference where he had a vial of white powder in his hand, a small amount, and he said that a teaspoon size quantity of anthrax in one of the letters had, you know, driven Washington into a state of chaos, killed two postal workers. And he suggested very pointedly that Iraq had stockpiled enough anthrax to, quote, fill tens upon tens upon tens of thousands of teaspoons.
Right.
So, I mean, he's definitely trying to stir up some. It's a fear mongering move, is what it is. And maybe it's well intentioned, but it seems to me like a pretty callous maneuver.
I'm just laughing because I think that's a fantastic example of just how far we in the United States will go to avoid using the metric system.
That's right? So funny.
It's true, though. He's like, put it in a number people can understand.
Tens upon tens upon tens upon tens.
Mm-hmm. If each spore of anthrax was the size of an Oreo and you stacked them on top of each other, they could reach, you know, whatever. As long as we don't use the metric system. That's one of the big rules. But there's another conspiracy here, the idea that the threat came closer to home, the idea that this was a false front or that some faction of the U.S. government actually planned this attack. You can imagine that for the people who believe 9/11 itself was a false flag, the anthrax attacks of 2001 were just another planned event or another sequence in a larger plan, another inside job. You know, this school of thought frames those attacks as a plan B, a backup measure, just in case 9/11 was not enough of a push to make the public and the government move forward with certain actions, then this sort of the equivalent of a double tap would ensure that the public moved in the direction that these powers, whoever they are, wanted. You know, it's strange because there's something comforting. This is weird, but walk with me here. There's something comforting about the idea that there is a grand design. You know what I mean? The idea that the same people who cannot get their stuff together on any given Tuesday are somehow also capable of this Rube Goldberg-esque control of the past, the future, and the present. I don't know. I feel like the idea that there's super villainy at work and a grand conspiracy is much more comforting than the other side of the coin, which is that...
What, that it's just chaos?
right. That maybe there's another conspiracy theory is that the FBI is covering up for governmental incompetence. Like, what about that political pressure? Like, what if they just, you know, what if they had people breathing down their necks saying, close this case now? Find me a person. Who's the creepiest guy that we know has touched anthrax?
This is the lowest hanging fruit possibility of them all. I mean, it makes the most sense. You know, you want to save face, you want to get the job done, even if it means putting away the wrong guy. You know, maybe they even had a hand in his suicide. You know, crazier things have been reported, you know, in terms of the government's involvement in assassinating folks and, you know, trying to cover that up, you know. So I have no problem believing this. And I find the false flag narrative to be just such a go-to kind of Looney Tunes one. Like, people are saying that about the COVID situation right now, that like it's a fault, like, you know, some people that don't believe that it's real. I equate it to like Holocaust denial or something. It's like, dude, there's bodies piling up. They're making, like, you know, ice skating rinks in New York into makeshift morgues. Like, it's real, you know, like, move on.
Yeah, I would say, you know, to that point, the U.S. government is such a Byzantine, complicated, maze-like structure with so many people involved and so many groups involved that it is completely possible for factions of the U.S. government to do things that the, you know, that other groups in the government don't know about or would object to. Like, the CIA is the go-to example there. They're doing all sorts of dirty stuff, and there are people who are supposed to have oversight of that organization, and they have no idea what's going on. You know, they're in the dark. And the FBI has done some very filthy things, too, in the past. So I can see where this is coming from. At this point, there is no conclusive proof that anyone affiliated with the government in a law enforcement capacity conspired to mail anthrax to people. But the problem remains. This is the biggest problem here. The science upon which the FBI's conclusion depends is not itself sound, regardless of whether you think the FBI found their culprit or whether you know what, if you think that some government agents actually conducted this attack, or if you think that political pressure rushed the investigation, there is one thing for sure, and that is numerous experts, not just Dr. Ivan's colleagues, agree the FBI has never conclusively proven Dr. Ivins was 100% the man behind the mail. And all that lab work, that is what the case hinges on. And it's not solid.
There's a really fantastic series on ProPublica, one of which is, was FBI's science good enough to ID anthrax killer? And we talked about this a little bit earlier, but just to hit home again, to quote the article, investigators had invented a new form of genetic fingerprinting for the case, testing anthrax collected from U.S. and foreign labs for mutations detected in the attack powder. Out of more than 1,000 samples, only 8 tested positive for 4 mutations found in the deadly germs sent to Congress and the news media. Even so, the outside scientists, quote, known as the Red Team, urged the FBI to do more basic research into how and when the mutations arose to make sure the tests were sound and the results unchallengeable. And they didn't do that. So, you know, this review showed that the FBI definitely overstated its case and possibly would not have gotten a conviction. In fact, seems to me quite likely would not have gotten a conviction against Ivins because they based their conclusions on some pretty shaky science.
And what does Dr. Ivins think? We'll never know because, again, he died of an overdose of Tylenol codeine, or as you said, Noel, Tylenol 3, that was ruled a probable suicide. So he never got his day in court. And technically, in this country, days in court are, you know, they're a thing. They're a tradition that we like to say we practice. But you know what I mean.
Oh, I know. It's a formality at times. It seems really just kind of like a smokescreen of, hey, look, justice is being carried out, you know, but It quite often is not, you know. There is that court of public opinion, and this is really all Dr. Ivins truly got tried in, and he was pilloried, and he, lost his life because of it. And you know, he may have been a weirdo, and he may have had a hand in this, but I don't buy that he was acting alone. If he had anything to do with it at all,
yeah, that's the issue. Let's, you know, there's one person that we should introduce here at the toward the end of this episode, and that is Claire Fraser Liggett. She was a pivotal member of the Amerithrax. God, I can't believe that's the real name. The Amerithrax investigation. She was a genetic consultant working with the FBI, one of those people who helped nail down the specific type of anthrax. Let's give the last word to her. Again, this is an expert. This is one of the protagonists, right? This is a person who's attempting to solve this case. And she says, quote, "This was not an airtight case by any means. You know, I think that for an awful lot of people, there is a desire to really want to say that, yes, Ivins was the perpetrator. This case can reasonably be closed and we can put this tragic chapter in U.S. history behind us. But I think part of what's driving that is the fact that if he wasn't the perpetrator, then it means that person is still out there."
So if not Bruce Ivins, then who? That's the question we leave you with today. What do you think? Please let us know. You can write to us in the usual places, the social medias, or we're some form of conspiracy stuff or conspiracy stuff show. You can also find us as individuals on social media. I am on Instagram at HowNowNoelBrown.
And you can find me on Twitter at BenBullenHSW. You can also find me on Instagram in a burst of creativity calling myself at Ben Bullen. Do you hate social media? Totally get it. Why not leave us a message? Give us a call. You can reach us at 1-833-STDWYTK. Feels weird when we're not saying it together. I miss when Matt says this. I hope he likes this episode.
I do too. I really hope he likes this episode, and it's a bummer that he isn't here for it, but I hope we did him proud. And speaking of Matt, if you call that number that we just mentioned, even now while Matt's on vacation, he may give you a call back. No promises, but he's been known to do it. He's a lovely man and would love to talk to you.
I wouldn't even say that's a promise. I would say consider it a warning. Be careful with doors you open.
Exactly, exactly.
So do let us know. And while you're at it, let us know if there are any other stories of scientists who have died under mysterious circumstances. If there's another angle of the anthrax attacks that you feel like your fellow listeners should know about, you can tell us, as Noel said, on social media. You can also find us on your local telephone. And if you say, hey, I hate phones, hey, I hate social media, but I have something you need to know, we are all ears, we are all eyes. You can reach us 24/7 any day of the year, any time of the day, at our good old-fashioned email address, where we are
conspiracy@iheartradio.com.
Stuff They Don't Want You to Know is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.